As demonstrated by Stalin's Holodomor and Mao's Great Leap Forward, the most effective way to control people is to control their food. So we ask, should we take the necessary steps to cook food for each other?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the, the 1,306th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Ensenada who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, let's begin with Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in that food. Makes sense, doesn't it? If you eat a carrot from your garden, you have a lot of control over what's in that carrot. But if you eat a carrot that came from thousands of miles away, you have very little control over what's in that carrot. Now let's look back to 1932 and 33 at Joseph Stalin's Great Holodomor, during which the leader of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics deliberately starved to death some 7 to 10 million Ukrainian farmers. Most of them were farmers at any rate. And now let's look to 1958 and 1962 at Mao's Great Leap Forward, during which the great helmsman of the People's Republic of China starved to death some 50 million people, most of whom were farmers. That two people, Stalin and Mao, could starve 60 million farmers to death could only mean one thing. 60 million farmers gave control of their food to those two people. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. Given the history of what happens to people when they give up control of their food to others, we ask, should we take the necessary steps to cook food for each other? Well, here to help us cook up an answer, we have Roya Baghari, who is the executive director of Cook Alliance. Roya, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. Really happy to be here.
Well, good. Glad to have you. And you folks at Cook Alliance have been on the forefront of cooking up some independence for quite a while now, and we're going to get to that history. But first of all, how did you become involved in this food jihad of cooking up food for each other?
Yeah, it's a fun story, but I'm actually an attorney, and I started my career doing that traditional big international law trajectory, and then decided, you know, I want to get back to the roots of being able to help individuals. So I started working for a nonprofit law firm where I was managing a micro business and nonprofit support program. And through that, we were providing free pro bono legal assistance to lower income entrepreneurs. And the majority of the people that kept on approaching me, would explain, I'm cooking and selling food from my home kitchen. This is how I'm making my living. This is how I'm helping support my family. A lot were, immigrants and my answer at the time was, and I was based out of San Diego, was unfortunately, what you're doing is not legal, and so we can't help you. And so that's how I became involved in this mission of, and got, connected with the Cook Alliance, who were the nonprofit that sponsored AB626, which, legalized home kitchens in throughout the state of California. But in California, the way that the law is implemented is that each county has to opt in. And so I became very involved in the efforts to get San Diego County to opt in, and just met a whole bunch of different home cooks and food entrepreneurs and realized that, this was an incredibly, valuable effort and mission that I wanted to dedicate more of my time to, basically all of my time to. So it became a real personal mission for me as well. to really be there to help create this inclusive pathway to empower entrepreneurs to generate income, test their business concepts, providing flexibility for those who need to work from home, and more than anything, just increasing consumer access to diverse, healthy local foods.
There you go. And really, there seems to be a bit of the jihad here, Roya. Am I wrong? There's a little bit of a holy war here for you, correct?
I mean, it's definitely become a personal mission. It's just all about, you know, the people that I've been able to talk to and connect with. And, my parents immigrated to the country as well. And I just see this as an incredible opportunity to share food and do it in a legal way. I mean, most people that I talk to don't even realize that it is actually not legal to sell food out of a home kitchen. So,
and in that regard, it seems kind of silly when you actually think about it. Why is it illegal to share food from our kitchen? Holy smokes. Let me ask you this, Roya. Do you think Americans are in danger of giving up control of their food to somebody else, like they did in the Soviet Union and China?
I mean, I think that's an interesting question in that we haven't had this opportunity available to us. So I see a lot of this as, you know, kind of taking back control by pushing for allowing people to, you know, sell food out of their home kitchens. This is giving them a freedom that frankly we should have already had. And most people realize that we don't already have it, but, I think in a way it's a way for us to regain some of that independence and to be able to, you know, help build these community ties.
How on earth did we lose that control of our food? Why is it illegal to share food out of our kitchen? How did it become illegal and maybe even immoral? What happened?
You know, I don't know that. That's a very good question, but I don't know that it was ever legal. I mean, we have health departments and at the end of the day, food safety is something to be concerned about. And so, I do feel like having that structure and the reason why we're aiming to push this to be legal in a way that works with health departments and also, allows for food safety is a huge part of our mission. But the history of it, you can look around. I mean, even in places like Cuba, you know, you have home kitchens thriving and being, a formal part of their economy versus here where it can become that, hopefully.
And there you go. Now, let's back up a little bit and talk about Cook Alliance. It is the nonprofit of which you are the executive director. So give us a thumbnail, please.
Yeah, so the Cook Alliance essentially is a nonprofit whose mission is to establish a just and people-powered food system. We believe that legalizing home kitchens and home cooking in the United States creates more economic access for cooks, healthy food options for customers, cultural exchange for communities. And we were the primary sponsor behind the first home restaurant bill in the United States, which was EB 626 in California. And now we're building off of that and working to ensure equitable, accessible implementation in early adopting states and extending that same opportunity to more home cooks across the nation. And we're, also increasingly active in supporting new cottage food policies and other local food movement initiatives. We look at this as a home-cooked food revolution, and we see it as really beginning, and therefore we're wanting to spread the word and hope, some of your listeners today can also become involved.
Mm-hmm. And for those people who do not know, home food is kind of becoming quite the little jihad among people like Roya, people who just want to see us retake the ability to feed ourselves with the food that we grow and cook. Simple as that. But yet, it is not as simple as that because there's a lot of opposition to that. So let's go back in a little bit and talk about some of the developments that have occurred in the food freedom movement. 2015, Wyoming passed the Food Freedom Act. And it's pretty much they've taken all the restrictions out of everything. And you talked about food safety, Roya, but in all of the years now that Wyoming has had its Food Freedom Act, there has been no foodborne illnesses recorded at all. So how much do we really need to worry about food safety with respect to home cooking and whatnot?
I think what's so incredible about home cooking is the connections that you can form with, you know, the home cooks that you're, you know, getting your food directly from. And when you have that person-to-person connection and you know exactly who's cooking your food, I think there's a heightened level of safety that's taken. And the home cooks that I've spoken to are like, who express, you know, previously when they were working in a restaurant, for example, they said the food would touch multiple different hands. And you know, even when you're cooking the food, you don't exactly know. And that's not to say that that restaurants aren't safe, but, you know, they've all expressed that when they're cooking in their own home and they're cooking for someone who they're directly handing that food to, that, you know, there's sort of a heightened level of wanting to make sure that, that you're protecting your community and not putting out unsafe food. So I think that's where, you know, there haven't been really many food safety complaints that we've heard of in places where there are like food freedom. And even, you know, now that microenterprise home kitchen operations, which is what we refer to as, you know, the acronym is MECO. It's, you know, the home base operation that they're allowed to have legally in California. Basically, we found in over 2 years of implementation there, and you know, over 100,000 meals sold, that there have been zero food safety complaints. And so it's been very successful, and I think that that has to do a lot with that human-to-human element and connection.
You know, one of my mantras has always been food with its farmer's face on it, because I think if you can look into the farmer's eyes, or the cook's eyes for that matter, you can pretty much see what's in the food. And if you are the farmer or you are the chef and you're looking at the person buying your food, you're much more apt to be concerned about the impact of your food on that person. Got to live with them, right? Than you would be if you were, you know, a farmer in China selling food to somebody in Madison, Wisconsin. You don't know who that person is. They're way far away, and there's no way to even know what kind of person they are. So you lose that when you, the farther away you get from the source of your food, the less control you have over what's in that food. So, ladies and gentlemen, today we're talking with Roya and Baghari, who is in San Diego, and she is with she's the executive director of Cook Alliance, which is an organization that's trying to give us, you and I, some measure of control back for our food, in that we can eat food from our neighbors' kitchens, and our neighbors can eat food from our kitchens. And if you think about it, it's a very much of a revolutionary kind of effort to put forth so that we can have that freedom to eat food from our neighbors. This is Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson right back. Do stay tuned.
The Pajaro Valley, hometown USA. Join us at the Pajaro Valley Chamber of Commerce Annual Awards Dinner and Auction on July 29th at the Santa Cruz County Fairgrounds. Celebrate the accomplishments of Trina Kaufman Gomez, Dana Sales, El Vaquero Winery, Casa de Cultura, the Fairgrounds Foundation Crab Feed, and receiving Lifetime Achievement Guy George. For reservations, visit PajaroValleyChamber.com. That's PajaroValleyChamber.com. See you there!
When your business is on the move, you must find the right place for it to move. Hello folks, Michael Olson here. When Santa Cruz Voice had to move, and move fast, we called on the power brokers at J.R. Parrish Commercial Real Estate in Santa Cruz, and they helped us move to the right place fast. Let's ask Matt Chelton, General Manager of J.R. Parrish, the big question. What is the right place to move one's business?
Location, location, location. Sometimes if you're in the service commercial business, the location of your customers is important. Sometimes it's the location of your employees. Sometimes it's the location of the people that own and operate the business. Sometimes it's rent. Sometimes it's the fact that there aren't that many buildings available to suit you. But mostly it's location of your customers, location of the principals, location of your employees.
When your business is on the move, move it to the right place with the help of the power brokers at J.R. Parrish in Santa Cruz.
JRParrish.com.
You have to move now. No problem. Store your stuff at Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul. Easy off Highway 1 on Airport Boulevard by the airport. 24/7 security. Drive it to your door and store it at Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul in Freedom.
You sold your motorcycle to a friend in Fresno and need to deliver it. Well, Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul in Freedom has motorcycling car trailers ready to go. Easy off Highway 1 on Airport Boulevard by the airport. Anbar Self-Storage and U-Haul in Freedom.
California coast to the fertile valleys inland. Earthwise Land Service is your land's best friend. Earthwise can clear it, mulch it, move it, sculpt it, grade it, drain it, or retain it any way you choose. Earthwise Land Service is your land's best friend.
Hi, I'm Carolyn, and I have some property behind my home at Larkin Valley that I've never seen. It was completely overgrown with brush and poison oak, well over 10 feet high. I wanted to have it cleared to protect my horses from wildfires, but nobody could do the job. Then I called Buck at Earthwise. Buck brought out his big brush-eating machine and turned all the brush and poison oak into mulch. It was truly transformational. Thanks to Earthwise, my property is now like a park, and I can trail ride my horses.
Earthwise Land Service is your land's best friend.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, we're talking about taking control back of our food. Roya, do you think we Americans are in danger of losing that control? Are we in danger of losing the ability to feed ourselves?
I mean, I think one of the things that the recent pandemic has kind of highlighted is that, you know, we need to be in a position where we're able to provide for ourselves regardless of what's happening in the outside world, regardless of, you know, if there are, you know, restaurants out there or other sources of food. And so diversifying our opportunities, you know, especially in this day and age, is something that we as Americans should definitely be looking at and supporting those that are hoping to do so.
Well, your organization, Cook Alliance, has some beliefs that you put right up there in front of the community vis-a-vis your website. And I thought the points made were very interesting. So thought maybe you would be kind enough to lead us through them and tell us exactly what you're thinking. Number one, modern capitalism has increased material wealth, but at great cost to people and planet. Nowhere is this more evident than in the industrial food system. What mean you by that?
Yeah, so I mean, if you keep reading, we've laid it out on our website, but I'll lay it out for you again here. So processed food and diets has become a top risk for mortality in the U.S., with well-established links to heart disease, diabetes, and other deadly epidemics. Crop monocultures and agricultural practices threaten our planet and exacerbate global warming. 7 out of the 10 lowest paid jobs are in the restaurant industry, with women, immigrants, and workers of color concentrated in the lowest paying segments. And so we see this as the same industry that has trained us to outsource our self-care by responding to our basic cravings for the cheapest, most convenient, and most addictive products. And so increasingly our time, energy, and money is spent on food made by corporations, not by loved ones, leaving us more isolated and eroding in the practice of caring for each other through food. And that's where we see, you know, a lot of food deserts have popped up, and, you know, the access to healthy food has really diminished. And so we see home kitchen operations and legalizing home-cooked food as a solution to this epidemic.
But it is a solution to people, but not so much to the corporations that provide most of our food. I would assume that you're a threat to them. Am I wrong?
I mean, it is such a large industry. You know, there's going to be a place for, you know, at the end of the day, fast food as well as, you know, restaurants. We see this as an ecosystem that has a lot of room to mm-hmm. grow and space for people, especially, you know, space for women, people of color, those who traditionally have been left out of the food economy. This is just a way to expand upon that and hopefully have everybody coexist in a way that also provides healthy access to.
Well, one of the economies about those who have economies of scale is that they tend to work on very, very thin margins. You know, maybe a penny or two per dollar of income. And so one of the things I learned in putting Metro Farm out there into the world is that those who grow with industrial technologies aren't at all welcoming of those who grow in or near the city for the city, because they can challenge that razor-thin margin that the industrial people make. So I would suspect that you are a threat if people are feeding themselves. I mean, if I was able to, on my way home from work, stop at the neighbors and pick up a couple meals, that would be a threat to a restaurant industry, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting part is that we have had, you know, conversations with, you know, restaurant associations and individuals that are, you know, very ingrained in that restaurant community. And a lot of times the conversation starts off with them, you know, feeling a little bit threatened by home kitchen operations. But then, you know, once we're able to actually explain what this opportunity is and how a lot of people are looking at this also as a stepping stone to eventually opening up a restaurant, for example, then it becomes a lot more inclusive. And so we've had actually in certain places, the restaurant industry call in support of this.
So it sounds to me like it's a good opportunity. Yeah, it sounds to me like it's a good job for a trial lawyer. You might fit right in making that argument. Then. Well, let's see. The second point.
Definitely use my attorney skills there.
There you go. The second point is, all over the world, consumers are becoming more informed and sophisticated about the ramifications of industrial food, not just nutritionally, but environmentally and socially as well. How do you know that people all over the world are waking up to the fact that, I guess the way to put it is that they're giving up control of their food?
I mean, I think we live in such an incredible day and age with advanced technology, social media, just with more communication and connection. I think we're being able to, you know, take that education into our own hands as well. And so as, you know, things have expanded and people are realizing that so much of their food is basically out of their hands, it's coming from thousands and thousands of miles away where they're not, you know, aware of, you know, what individual ingredients are. I think that awareness has actually increased the amount of people really wanting to kind of rise up against that and say, no, I want to, you know, small is beautiful, and we want to be able to have those person-to-person connections, know exactly where our food is coming from. And I think that's why, you know, the momentum is really building around this movement right now, with people being able to turn around and say, okay, I want to be able to look the home chef in the face and be able to actually know exactly where my food comes from. And we've seen some really and heard some really incredible stories around that, like people who get into this because of family members that have cancer and wanting to, you know, provide home cooked food that is healthier and targeted. People who are able to, you know, we spoke with someone who's battling cancer and said, I can no longer order from restaurants, or, you know, I have to make everything myself and I'm just exhausted by that. But with a legal Miko, I'm able to go to them and say, hey, can you not use these ingredients? Or, you know, can Can you not include salt in my food? And because it is so small scale and one-on-one and personal, you know, a home cook is able to make those adjustments and accommodate for allergies and, you know, really kind of bring that back to that, that person-to-person community feel that, that so many are now looking for because they recognize that, that, you know, food has become so large and distant in a lot of ways.
Good. And the third point you make really struck me because, you know, when I put Metro Farm on the table, people said, well, what do you grow? And I said, well, if you look at the metropolitan appetite, it wants whatever is new and exciting and different. But if you're growing food in an industrial setting with industrial technology, what you're going to grow is commodities. And whoever grows the most for the least wins that commodity race. But city people aren't hungry for commodities. They don't want a field tomato. They want a vine-ripened, dry-farmed heritage tomato that tastes like a tomato and is thrilling in its taste. And so you make mention of the fact that people are waking up to the fact that, that to get those kinds of foods, you're going to have to go to somebody who actually can provide them. And that generally is not industrial agriculture.
Yeah, I mean, I think this just expands opportunities. I know that a lot of even Miko home cooks are looking at growing some of their own food just in their garden and using that as ingredients or setting up relationships with individuals at local farmers markets or local farms. And so there's just a lot of potential and opportunity there. And we found that people, you know, are willing a lot of times now to pay a little bit extra for being able to trace their food and know that, you know, that that's money that's staying local in their local economy.
There you go. Now, you called it Miko. Is that what you the name you used? Miko Home Cooks?
Yes, exactly. So it's at least in California, the acronym is it's a micro enterprise home kitchen operation, and so we found it just simple to kind of use the acronym MICO as you know this explanation of what this home kitchen operation essentially you know is, and it really does highlight that it is meant to be you know small scale, but it just has such incredible opportunity for the community.
Well, good. I'd like to pick up the Miko world and begin with the home kitchen. You started the movement by saying, hey, it's okay to make some jam and sell it to the neighbor, right? That's kind of where the home kitchen enterprise started with that kind of endeavor.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely, this does feel like a natural extension of cottage food. And cottage food, you know, has been around since, you know, before 2012, and actually New Jersey became the last state in 2021 to actually implement a cottage food law. So now, you know, across the U.S., there are, you know, legal cottage food laws in place for people to be able to sell, like you said, you know, jams, shelf-stable foods. Mm-hmm. But what really distinguishes, you know, this MICO movement, microenterprise home kitchens, and this home cooking movement that we're now trying to expand upon is that it allows for selling, you know, hot meals, cold meals, meals that have meat in them, which is also where there's a lot of distinctions with food freedom, because in a lot of food freedom states, you still can't sell, like, for example, red meat as a part of a dish that you're cooking. And so it creates, you know, this opportunity to expand upon, you know, what is considered a traditional menu and offer that to individuals. And so it is this natural extension, and we're hoping that it grows across the country, especially because of the circumstances that we live in now and, you know, the spotlight that was shined upon it all by the pandemic and people needing to have that avenue of working from home. You know, we're hoping that this momentum can really build and that home kitchen operations can extend across the country in a manner that hopefully will be even faster than cottage food.
So you're kind of like the camel's nose in the tent, right?
Can you explain more on that?
Well, we're always warned not to let the camel stick his nose into the tent, because if the camel sticks his nose in the tent, the rest of his body will soon follow. So with respect to the Food Freedom Act, the cottage food industry world is kind of like the camel's nose in the tent, and now the rest of the body's coming in too, and here we come, ready or not, because we're talking about actually providing meals to people. And this is a significant, is it allowed anywhere? The home kitchen restaurant meals?
Yeah, so it was our nonprofit helped pass AB 626, which was the first law of its kind in the entire nation. As I mentioned previously, there's a county by county opt-in, but Riverside County back in 2019 opted in. And so we have, you know, over 2.5 years of incredible data from legal home kitchens that have been able to sell, you know, obtain a permit, sell their food, and just really incredible data out of that, which shows that, you know, the majority of these permitted chefs are, you know, women, people of color. They're able to get more education and resources, and there have been zero food safety issues, even with regards to, you know, code enforcement compliance with like traffic noise, signage, and odors, which is a concern that we often hear. We found that, you know, even that there's been 98.5% compliance rate. There were only 2 complaints that were quickly addressed, and this is with over 100 of these legal permitted, you know, home kitchens operating in Riverside County. And so it's working. We have that data to show that it really is this incredible opportunity, and you know, a lot of the fears are unfounded around this. And it can actually be successful if given the opportunity.
We have a minute left before the break, but what is the principal objection to home kitchens and home restaurants?
I mean, I think there's the fear around basically what we've been able to disprove. There's the fear around the food safety aspect of things. There's fear that there's going to be increased, you know, traffic noise in neighborhoods, you know, and again, we have data to show that that's largely unfounded, and that people really enjoy having this in their backyards, in their neighborhoods, and having this opportunity to buy from their neighbors.
It would almost seem like it would increase the safety viability of a community to have an ongoing enterprise like that, because whoever's running the enterprise is going to make certain everything's running smoothly and not bothering the neighborhood. But that's just my thought. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're talking about food freedom with Roya Beghari. Beghari, how do you pronounce it? Beghari.
It's Beghari.
Beghari. Okay. Beghari. Roya Beghari, Executive Director of Cook Alliance. And we're talking about whether we should be able to open up a restaurant in our home and sell our food to our neighbor. Right back.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutrientsToGo.com.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. BusinessMoneyToGo.com.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So, back when 60 or so million people, most of whom were farmers, gave control of their food, total control of their food, to a couple guys. Joseph Stalin was one, Mao Zedong was the other, and when they gave up total control of their food to these two people, the two people turned on them and deliberately starved them to death. And you just got to wonder why people would turn over the total control of their food to two people who live somewhere else on top of a skyscraper in a big city. Why would they do that? I think that's going to be one of history's great mysteries when it gets right down to it. But there are those who don't think we should, and as a matter of fact, are doing what they can to take back a lot of the control that has been given up through the years to various agencies represented by people. And one of them are the folks from Cook Alliance. And we have with us Roya Baghari, who is executive director of Cook Alliance, and she's telling us today about her effort to expand the ability of people to have a restaurant in their own home. So, Roya, I think a great place to start this segment is, how do we set up a restaurant in our home?
Yeah, so in states where it is legal, so California and the counties where it has been implemented. And I'm actually happy to say that San Diego County will start permitting as of this Friday. And so it'll be the largest jurisdiction in the country with, you know, over 3.3 million people living in that community to legalize this. But the state of Utah has also legalized this. There's also pending legislation in a number of other states as well. And so this movement is really gaining momentum. But essentially, in an area where it is legal and there's a permit that's available, it means that a home kitchen operator can go to the health department and obtain a permit. And as a part of that permit process, they do end up getting access to more education. So they would have to go through the process of obtaining a food manager certification. And then there is a one-time inspection that is a part of obtaining that permit. And so, inviting the health department into their home kitchen to show that, they're able to have the space to properly prepare a meal. And so then once they do actually have that permit through the health department, then they're able to start cooking and selling food out of their kitchen. And in California, there are technically three ways that they can sell the food. They can either, have people pick up their food directly, or they can invite people into their home to sit down for a meal, like, for example, in a backyard as like a part of a pop-up event or a cooking class or, what you would consider more of that traditional restaurant feel, even though it does have to be on a much smaller scale.
Kind of a family-like setting of dinner, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And then the third option is via delivery. There are limitations in place in California through that law, but, just delivering specific meals. And there are, caps in place as well, in terms of, numbers of meals per day and amount of sales, because it is meant to be an incubation space.
Why the limitations?
So, at least in California right now, there's micro sales are limited to a maximum of 30 meals per day and 60 meals per week, which technically is less than the amount of food that would be cooked per week for a family of four. That's kind of in place, at least at the start, so that, people can see that working with health departments, that this is, safe. And we're hoping that, one day down the road, we can eventually increase those caps and show that the data, really proves that that this is a safe way to sell food.
But at least you have the nose in the tent, right?
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Okay, good. So we're on the road. We can do this. And a couple of communities in California, a couple of counties. Now, what is it going to take to, one, expand this to every county in California, and two, expand it to every state in the nation?
Yeah, so we've been looking at the state of Utah has recently in 2021 also passed a bill for legalizing this process, and there's pending legislation in other states as well. But in terms of California counties, we have an incredible network of volunteers and advocates who are out there, trying to let their county supervisors know that this is something that's really wanted and needed in the community. And that's how I myself got involved with this whole process as well, as, being local in San Diego and working towards getting, that community to implement, which I'm just really happy to say that recently, all of those years of efforts paid off, and that, as of this Friday, people are going to be able to obtain that permit in San Diego. But it's, this movement is really gaining momentum. And as of right now, we're up to 10 jurisdictions in California, with many more looking into the opportunities around opting in. And, the more we get, the more positive data we can show, the more people we're really helping. So it's an exciting time right now.
A very attractive jihad to be involved with. It sounds like fun because it's about food and it's about good food. Now, tell us a little bit about what would make a good home restaurant. Start with a kitchen. What do we need?
So one thing I will say, and we haven't talked about too much yet, is that there is already a huge informal food economy of people that are already selling food from their home kitchens. What's so great about legalizing this opportunity is that it lets these people come out of the shadows. It helps them, because right now, current unlicensed home cooks face possible fines, consumers face public health risks, this becomes something that's out of reach for so many individuals. But by legalizing this and by actually creating this permitting system, people can come out from the shadows and gain access to education and safety guidelines and, you know, business tips. There's a whole community of, nonprofits that can then provide support and education, which is really, you know, incredible to helping people grow their business in that way, you know, whether they want it to be to stay as a home kitchen operator or to make that jump into, you know, like a food truck or catering or, mm-hmm. A brick and mortar. But what's just so great is that in being able to obtain this permit, they can come out from the shadows. They can get that food manager certification. They can start forming these connections.
And they can tell their neighbors. They can advertise. Look at me. Look what I have for food. Look what you can eat when you come to my house. You can.
Yeah, it's really about neighbors and neighborhood. And I've talked to so many people that say, I want to get into this. I want to do this to begin with because, you know, my neighbor is a single mom, works a full-time job, comes home at night and isn't able to feed a home-cooked meal to her kids. But I can do that. And, you know, I can provide, you know, I can go out and get the food and cook it and, you know, provide it to them. But right now with existing laws in certain places, they could be penalized for doing something like that. So, this is just really about making this, an opportunity that is available to people and, again, helping local neighborhoods.
What kind of food, if you were, Roya, if you were going to open a home restaurant this coming Friday?
Yeah, Friday is when people can start applying.
So what can I get when I go to Roya's house for food? What are you going to serve?
Oh, that is a very good question. I love food, and what's been such a joy in this work is being able to meet so many home cooks that are sharing, you know, their cultural background through food. And sharing really, you know, authentic, wonderful dishes. I'm Persian, and so I would probably try to, you know, create, you know, Persian food oriented home kitchen operation. Although it's funny, I think I would probably have to have my mom come in and help me really like hone in those the dishes and set my menu and all of that. And But again, so many people that we are helping get this, permit are people that are now able to share their authentic, you know, family recipes, and sharing, you know, their home, you know, soul food. And so there just is a lot of diversity out there in home kitchens. And so we're hoping that, you know, especially people who are, I mean, the foodie culture right now is huge. And so having this be a part of that scene, I think is going to be really incredible as well.
Well, if you think about it, you know, the typical American neighborhood probably has about 49 ethnic possibilities for food when it gets right down to it. So, a single neighborhood could be, you know, a wonderful bounty of tastes. Because so many people have so many different heritages, and it would just be a great opportunity. But still, it seems like it's a great big threat to somebody to have that potential bloom and grow and become a real movement wherein people actually, where you have a dozen, you know, possibilities for home restaurants in your neighborhood. It seems like it is a threat to somebody.
I mean, I would definitely say the fast food industry for one, because, you know, we're hoping to replace that need for fast food with more options for healthy foods, especially in food deserts, where a lot of people just don't have any other options currently that then Nico's could fill that gap. But, you know, again, the food is just such, like, you know, everyone has to eat every single day. It's just such a huge, huge, you know, economy out there. And so we're hoping that, you know, people don't see this as a threat, but see this as, you know, a natural extension and see that, you know, people are already doing this informally, that this is actually, you know, underground. These already are things that exist. Mm-hmm. And so there's it's not really a threat because it's already there. And what's happening is this is just creating more inclusion and more opportunity, and lets people not have to continue these operations in fear of getting, you know, a knock from their health department.
Sure.
It's just, you know, an expansion of opportunity, and we hope people can see it as such, as opposed to, you know, the negative.
Let's go back for a moment to Roya's Persian Kitchen Cafe. How much would it cost Roya to set something like that up? I'm sure you thought about it, being in there.
Yeah. So what is so absolutely incredible about, you know, Miko's, about this opportunity is that, you know, if you look at the traditional food industry, if I wanted to open a restaurant, I'm looking at, you know, especially in California, likely over $400,000, you know, definitely over $200,000 to just get a brick and mortar set up, let alone if I wanted to, you know, do a food truck, which many see as a more accessible option, that's still $50,000 at least in upfront costs. Even, you know, catering out of a commercial kitchen, that's still also, you know, around that. But the all-in cost of a micro-enterprise home kitchen operation is, you know, less than $1,000. The permits itself, they come out to, like, on average around $600. And then, you know, if you're getting a business license, that food manager certification, and any additional food safety supplies, we've found that on average that's still less than $1,000. So that's, you know, your all-in cost, and just think of how much more accessible that is for people to be able to afford.
And what a wonderful way to start. You know, I've always been had this fantasy about starting a restaurant, but I don't have $400,000. Well, you don't need it. You could just set yourself up in business and hang out a shingle and you're in business, and you can see whether what you want to do or what you dream of doing is something that's a real thing. One quick last question, Roya Beghari. What can I do as a consumer to help build this world of home restaurants?
Yeah, so we're always looking for, you know, volunteers, for people who, you said you're located out of Santa Cruz, you know, we're looking at implementation in places like Santa Cruz, like the more people that can just call in or give public testimony, or even just write, you know, a short e-comment saying that we want this in our communities, you know, mm-hmm. as long as our legislators are then hearing that from our mouths, then that's something that we can move forward with. But also, you know, once you know, Miko's are available in your community by patronizing, by becoming a patron and working.
And that's what I was looking for. Eat and buy the food and enjoy and smile. Wow. Roya Beghari,
exactly.
Thank you so much for joining us today from Cook Alliance, COOK Alliance. You can find her there. And find yourself a home restaurant and patronize it, and we'll build a whole new world for ourselves. Thank you, Roya, for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and we hope, you know, to have more people as a part of this movement. So, you know, join us and eat amazing food.
There you go. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.